I'll call the meeting of the Public Commission of the Oregon Legislature, the Public Institution Committee, to order here on March 13th. Welcome, everyone. Committee members present are Mr. Herring and Ms. Schutte and Judge Pryor, and myself and Ms. Feast just arrived, too. We're glad to see Jane here with us today. And Justice Lindy, who's not a member of the committee, may be joining us for our festivities here. We're going to begin with a discussion on intergovernmental relationships, which is a topic of great concern and passion to Judge Pryor here. I know this is one of her favorite topics, and we've invited probably two of the most important groups of city and county officials and leaders around Oregon are the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities. And we've invited them here today to testify for us and perhaps suggest some ways in which the intergovernmental relationships between the legislature and the counties and the cities might be improved. And so here with us today, I think on our first panel, or have them all come up, at the, we have Ben Boswell, who's president of the Association of Oregon Cities. Association of Oregon Counties. Leslie Lewis from Yamhill County, who's the chair of the AOC Governance Committee. Steve Bryant, who's acting president of the League of Oregon Cities. And Marilyn, do you want to join? Are you here too?
Oh, I'm here tomorrow.
You're just here to watch, okay. Marilyn Chaper, who's a Curry County Commissioner, is also here with us in the room. Ooh, and we have a high-tech slideshow. Sorry, Debbie, you can't see the slideshow here.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I'll get the CD and watch it.
All right. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I am Ben Boswell, Wallowa County Commissioner and President of the Association of Oregon Counties. We have a Gee Whiz show to show you. And so we'll proceed. We're here to kind of reinforce the concept of the one-size-does-not-fit-all approach to Oregon government. A lot is talked about, and we've done some analysis to kind of dig down into that premise. A free state is formed and maintained by the voluntary union of the whole people, joined together under the same body of laws for the common welfare and the sharing of benefits justly apportioned. I wonder if Plato hadn't had some experience with city and county governments. Lest you not recognize this, this is one of the sayings that's etched on the front of the Capitol. So it's especially appropriate that we begin here today. AOC represents 36 county governments and 118 elected county governing body officials, as well as other elected and appointed officials. We provide many services through an important state-county interconnected system. We have the authority over many parts of the interconnected system. In fact, we've just started a county college for continuing education for commissioners, and in our research, the history of counties discovered that Oregon counties have more authority than most counties in the rest of the nation because of the home rule provisions in the Oregon Constitution. However, in spite of this linkage, there is no venue for counties to formally interact with the policymakers of this interconnected system. So what we've come up with is this graphic representation of the shared services that we do enjoy. As you can see, the green ones are those primarily provided by the state government, the blue services primarily by local government, and the red services that are joined in shared services. And yet, counties serve the same 3.5 million Oregonians and various industries as the state legislature does. Counties cover the same 97,000 square miles. Counties employ over 18,000 Oregonians. The diversity of counties requires a flexible approach to statewide policy making. One size does not fit all. However, there is no mechanism in which to incorporate flexibility when needed. Now, I call that the law of unintended consequences. Here we've broken down the Oregon counties by population. From the largest group, as you can see, down to the smaller counties, which are now classified as frontier counties, as a description. The population, as you can see, 87% of the population occupying 31% of the area, 13% of the population occupying 69% of the area. But what does that mean on a county-by-county basis? We've chosen six counties to feature in this comparison. With respect to population, obviously, Multnomah, Lane, Jackson, Lincoln, Harney, and Wheeler County in that order. With almost two-thirds of a million people down to 1,500 people in the various counties. However, in area, it's almost the reverse, with Multnomah County at 465 square miles and Harney County at 225, a county larger than the state of Massachusetts. And then again, the density, 1,400 people per square mile in Multnomah, less than a person per square mile in Harney County. And just to start looking into one of the shared services, the road miles, the total road inventory, as you can see, is greatest in Lane County. The largest percentage of unpaid roads is in Wheeler County. And altogether, the 26,861 miles of county roads are 60%, or over half of the total highway system, as you include the state highway system. So what we have here is an example of the services that are provided at the local level. When a constituent or a consumer of highway services travels across the highway system, it's often not noticeable who is the proprietor of that system, whether it's a state, a county, or a city. And so, to the consumer of these services, there's no difference. We need to be sure that they notice no difference when they travel from one part of the system to another. Here's our shared services system again. And again, as we bore down into this, we use an example of the Oregon Community Corrections Program, whereby the state of Oregon has provided $174 million to the community corrections system. And yet local governments have provided $122 million by the time you include the grant to local governments. So without the financial participation of local governments, the community correction system would not be able to function in the state of Oregon. Counties then and cities become sometimes the invisible partner in the service delivery system, at least in terms of funding. And so we bring to you a proposal today to address that system. And for that, I turn it to Mr. Lewis.
I would note for the record that Commissioner Lewis is also a former legislator here in the building, so she brings a unique perspective of having seen it from both sides of the aisle, so to speak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Commission members. Yes, I did have the pleasure of serving here for three terms in the House during the 90s, and very much enjoyed my service here. In fact, Marjorie and I were talking earlier. She was my committee administrator her first time here at the legislature in 1997. But I will tell you this. Now as a county commissioner for Yamhill County, I have wished I'd served at the local government level before being a legislator, because I've learned a lot. And I think that brings us to one of the main issues that we have, and that is what we like to ask your help on. We hope it might appear in your recommendations when your commission has finished doing its work. And that would be to create in statute an Oregon Governance Council. And this would include leadership from the governor's office, the House leadership, both majority and minority, and the Senate leadership, majority and minority, and then a representative from the counties and a representative from the cities. And we believe that this is really important because we need to have better communications. As President Boswell has already shown you, the counties are the delivery arm for the state. There are many things that are mandated: mental health services, chemical dependency services, public health services, community corrections, which includes not only the Senate Bill 1145, residents in our jails, but also the parole and probation function. There's just many functions which the state mandates, and the counties are the delivery system for that. And because of that, we think we need a better way of being able to communicate and to actually be a more formal partner with the state agencies as they present both policy and budgetary issues at the legislature. And so I believe you've been passed out a copy of Senate Bill 969. That was a bill that the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities put in last session, and it would in fact create this governance council. We think there's good reasons for that. Counties at one time did have fairly limited roles. We basically provided the farm to market roads, provided the sheriff's patrol, and took care of the needy and did tax collections. But now, as I said, with the state mandating many other functions, we believe we need to have better communications with the governor and the legislature. This is modeled after several other states who have created governance councils: Florida, Iowa, North Dakota, Texas, and Virginia. And they, in turn, had modeled their councils after the Federal Advisory Commission. So I think we have some good models out there, and really believe that that would be an important thing to have come out of this commission as a recommendation to the governor and the legislature. Secondly, we believe, because of the shared nature of our services, that the counties and the cities need a better way to interface with the ways and means process during the development of the budget. And we have taken some steps with that. We were able to work with co-chair Schrader last session and get a budget note in Senate Bill 5520. And he has created an interim working group which will allow counties to be at the table and discuss with Senator Schrader and Representative Morgan some budget issues, again, around those shared services that we've discussed.
Senator Schrader, his wife is a county commissioner. I hope he was supportive.
Well, we that has been very helpful to us, definitely. But we think that this is critical. That oftentimes, and I will just give you my own experience, having served in the legislature and served as co-chair of Ways and Means my last session in 1999, I did not fully understand the partnership between counties and state government, and so I think it's really critical, not only just to make our points at budget time, but as an educational tool for legislators and for those involved in the Ways and Means process. And then our final recommendation is that local governments be given some ability to adopt variations to administrative rules, because oftentimes, as what President Boswell has shown you, there is a wide range of differences between counties throughout the state, and the one-size-fits-all approach, which typically comes out of both statutes and administrative rules, really does not fit very well when you talk about the diversity of a Wheeler County compared to a Multnomah County or compared to a Curry County. So we would like you to give some consideration as to how local governments might be able to adopt variations to administrative rules. That goes back to the flexibility that President Boswell mentioned earlier that is definitely missing from the current system. So those are our recommendations, and we'd be happy to answer any questions, or if you want to now hear from Steve Bryant from the League, we can turn the mic over to him.
A few questions and maybe some others before we go on. You know, the mission in charge of this whole commission, the legislative commission, is to search for ways and recommendations to make the legislature more effective, more efficient, more respected, all of the above. So from your point of view, from the county point of view, the legislature is not operating at its full capacity with the counties, or...
Are you trying to get me in trouble with my with my friends in the legislature? Well, I just would say I really think, you know, that there is a lack of understanding, quite frankly, of the role that counties play and how we really are a subdivision, a political subdivision of the state of Oregon, and yet we, for example, this last legislative session, the Ways and Means Committee broke their process into, I can't remember what they called it.
Three phases.
Mm-hmm. And we weren't invited to be in the early phase because we were viewed as a more of a special interest group as opposed to being really part and parcel of what a state agency delivers. Mm-hmm. So when the Department of Human Services makes their presentations and they're talking about delivering mental health services or chemical dependency services, they don't do that delivery. The counties do, and as a mandate from the state. So I think that there is a need for better communication with both the governor's office and the legislature, and a way for our role in state government, because we are part of state government, a way for our role to be better understood.
But my question, to play devil's advocate, isn't that what the AOC is for? I mean, to have something, you know, to adopt or recommend a new state bureaucracy, isn't that doing the job of the AOC and the LOC to an extent?
Well, from my perspective, Mr. Chair, AOC would still be doing the work that they do, but they would be able to work then by making recommendations to the Governance Council and having those recommendations then heard by the leadership of the legislature and the governor's office. And Judge Pryor's just dying to say something.
Judge Pryor, would you like to? I saw Hassel first. Hassel, did you have a question? So.
Well, you may have just answered my question at least partially, but just exactly how do you think that a Governance Council could overcome those hurdles to communication? I mean, how just what mechanically, what the Governance Council do that can't be done now?
Well, I think that it would make a more formal way of recognizing that counties and cities are in partnership with state government. And again, right now, we are viewed more as a special interest group than we are as someone who serves the same constituency that all of the legislators serve as well. So I think it gives us a seat at the table, so to speak, that we don't currently have.
Do you envision this commission having some kind of controlling power or influence over legislation, for example? Could veto legislation?
No, not be able to veto legislation, but in our bill that we wrote last session, we said that the council would study and make recommendations to the legislature, and that the council would be involved in drafting legislation that would then go before the full legislature when the legislature convenes. So, no, it would not have any veto power, but it would be a way of working on both policy and budget issues in the interim between legislative sessions, and then it would be able to present those recommendations to the legislature as a whole.
Do you think then this commission would exist primarily as a symbolic institution that sort of symbolizes the importance of counties and cities?
I don't believe it would be symbolism. I believe that again, with the ability, with having someone from the Speaker's office, someone from the President's office, someone from both the Senate and House minority offices, and a representative from the Governor's office, and along with a city representative and a county commissioner representative, I think that group would would be much more than symbolic, because they would work together on issues and then again draft recommendations to the legislature. So it would function more like a committee of the legislature, an interim committee of the legislature, or a task force would function.
Do you think then that these recommendations would have more weight for the legislature than recommendations coming from the League of Oregon Counties and or the cities?
Yes, sir, I do. I believe that if you were at a committee during legislature and you had sitting there the members of the governance council, and that included a member from the Speaker's office and the President's office and the House minority and majority offices and the governor, along with the counties and cities, I think it would carry much more weight than simply the association or the league on their own trying to push forward a policy initiative or a budget initiative.
Thank you.
Ms. Pryor?
I think what we have viewed here is a recognition of governance in Oregon, that there are three different pieces to that. The cities and the counties are a local piece, and the legislative body is a state piece. And without having a vehicle, a way to come together to talk about governance and the nuts and bolts of governance, it's very difficult. It's very difficult for cities and counties. They get to come in here every 2 years for however many times you can get here on whatever the issues are, and try to talk about the nuts and bolts of how it works, how these systems work. A good example is Measure 50. Measure 50 was such a crisis that all of a sudden you had the legislative body turning to the county's assessors and saying, how do we fix this? And then we ended up having to do that a couple of times because they were in this crisis mode and probably really didn't still get it right. So when you're talking about how the systems function, these big systems that we share the process in our society, there isn't any vehicle for the three different parts of government in the state of Oregon to be able to come together to talk about just the nuts and bolts of how does it function. Literally, and you can see from that list, the legislative body sets the budget for a lot of county government without input. What happens is they set the budget, and then later, after it's tried to be implemented, you may find out what the pitfall was or what the unintended consequence was of your action, because there was no way to involve in that early enough on in the process.
We've had this talk before just prior, but isn't this at the core some sort of competence question? I mean, one would expect that the leaders, the governor, the legislators, the state leaders, would be interacting with the commissioners in the League of Oregon Cities. I know, for example, if my boss is doing something that the commissioners don't like, county commissioners, we hear from them. And I'm just trying to juggle the thought of putting something into writing, forcing people to work together when they should be working together, I guess.
I don't think that it's so much an idea of forcing people to work together. It's a recognition of the governance of the state, how it's structured. And is there a way for it to function other than just either grabbing the phone and calling your boss and saying you're creating havoc with us here? Or when you have a state that goes from 500,000 people in one county down to 1,500 in the other, there's a lot of differences. And if you don't have the way to come together to talk about that as you're beginning to set policy or create programs or alter things, you're going to end up causing a lot more havoc than you would have if you had that process up on the front end and been able to talk about it early on.
So, Brian, do you want to chime in here before you ask more questions?
Sure. Again, Steve Bryant, and I'm the interim executive director for the League of Oregon Cities. By way of background, I spent 30-plus years working for the city of Albany, so I know that anything I say will be challenged by Mr. Herring here, and I expect some hard questions from him before I'm done.
I would also note, for the record, the presence in the back of Ray Knapp just came in, and he is the director of intergovernmental relations for the governor's office. So I think we've got everybody involved here, all the parties involved.
Perfect. And you're asking the right questions, and I'm going to just talk sort of conversationally about what I see happening. We, of course, represent 241 incorporated cities, the latest being Damascus, which incorporated most recently. And we have sort of the same issue that counties face, a very tremendous diversity between what our cities do and how they function, from Portland and the issues that they face and the way that they are governed, which is totally unique from most other cities that have completely volunteer city council members. In fact, in the state of Oregon, you might be interested to know there are only six paid elected officials, the five in Portland and one in Beaverton. Other than that, we're pretty much volunteers that govern our cities. And yet we're in the same partnership relationship that the counties have discussed. But what I have observed throughout my career is a continuing need that has never been addressed adequately to educate legislators on what cities do, how they function, how they're funded, and how legislation can severely impact how we govern and how we deliver services. By way of example of that, our primary funding sources are the things that you're probably familiar with. Number one, interestingly enough, is no longer the property tax, it's user fees. Because of restrictions on property taxes, cities, in order to deliver services, have had to resort to, you know, user pay type systems. Primarily that's with things that we sort of take for granted, our utility systems, sewer and water systems, but, you know, ambulance services, municipal court services, animal control, even to some extent the things that you normally think of as being free are no longer free because we have to find new ways to pay for things these days. So it hasn't just been the initiative process that you might expect that has limited those revenue sources. It's been things that have happened in this building. We are constantly doing battle, if you will, with highly paid lobbyists who contribute to campaigns to try to restrict the ways that government, local government especially, collects revenues. Our second largest source of revenue is probably property taxes, and you all know how that is restricted by the history of our initiative process in Oregon, but it's also restricted by legislative actions in that there are constantly, every session, groups that are wanting property tax exemptions or waivers or some way to offset the cost to their particular area, and that comes straight out of local government's pockets because state government doesn't depend on property taxes, local governments do. Next, we have things like franchise fees, a very large funding source for city governments for the utilities' use of rights of way within our cities. Constant legislative pressure, both at the state and federal levels, to restrict cities' ability to collect franchise fees, which is a significant part of our revenue source to provide public services. Just about any kind of fee for service that you might name, there is a group in Salem that's attempting to limit our ability to collect those fees, and they're often much more effective than we can be in selling their message. Although we try very hard, and the League of Oregon Cities has five full-time lobbyists that are trying to keep our issues in front of legislators that they understand how we operate and what we need. That's marginally effective, but if we could institutionalize a better understanding that we're not just another special interest group, but we are a partner in governance, I think that would change the dynamic significantly. So whether or not this is the right vehicle to do that, I think what we're suggesting to you is that a vehicle is needed. Another example of something that we ought to try to institutionalize is a better orientation system for legislators, especially newly elected legislators.
We've talked about that.
Great. For us, it's easy to work with legislators who have risen through the ranks of local government because they understand it. And as you just heard, the reverse might have worked better in some cases rather than going from legislature to local government if we somehow require that you first serve in local office, our job would be easier, but we know that's not going to happen. But if we could provide some sort of educational process at the front end, that would be, I think, enormously beneficial to us.
Representative Boone, do you have any thoughts on this matter, on the relationship?
Well, you're covering pretty much most of my questions, and that the first one was, is this something we really need? And as I'm listening to the discussion, I'm thinking, you know, it might not be a bad idea, because so often, especially during sessions, when things, the pace is so quick, sometimes the most missed item is standing right before you. And I know that, you know, I'm listening to the talk of why isn't it adequate to have the AOC and LOC lobbyists there. There's only so many of them, and they can only get around so much. And if someone forgets to mention something, and especially even, you know, with the governor and trying to keep track of him and all that he's trying to do, and all the members, I just think, I don't know how often you're talking about having this meet representative, or former representative and Commissioner Lewis, but I could see it as a freestanding but connected group, and just as kind of an oversight committee. Is that kind of what you have in mind in terms of how it would operate?
Thank you, Representative Boone, for the question. We did envision in the legislation having it meet, I believe it's quarterly, but of course that was just a suggestion when we drafted this legislation last session. I guess not necessarily oversight, but just as a committee that could work together to talk about how these three different parts of Oregon government do in fact govern cities, counties, and the state, and again how we could have these discussions. I think Mr. Bryant brings up a lot of good issues, the issues of that they always struggle with, because people don't understand that, oh yeah, it's nice to give that property tax exemption to XYZ group, but what does that do to the resources for the cities or counties? And I just think this would be a sounding board, a place where we could make sure that legislative leadership and the governor's office truly understands the effect of any piece of legislation that might affect cities or counties, again, both on policy and budget.
And sort of another set of eyes then, in that sense?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's not a bad idea at all. And at the risk of saying more committees, more groups, whatever, sometimes it's just a fresh pair of eyes that can catch something. I know that one of the things that the Rural Policy Advisory Committee is dealing with right now is the one size doesn't fit all. And this is something I was going to bring up today anyway, but and it might be a little premature, but I could see a group like this being able to, you know, pass it by, just kind of like the Ocean Policy Advisory Council looks at a lot of legislation that they might not find, you know, just gets passed to them. They might not see it on their own individually. So.
And staff has provided us with an outstanding summary of different committees by the states, the ones you named. So
okay,
would urge all commission members, well, I mean, should be taking a look at this in the weeks to come. Commissioner Cease and Commissioner Lindy have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might preface my questions by saying that I served on local government committees the entire time that I was in both the House and the Senate for 13 years, and I have interesting memories of Representative and then Senator Otto prefacing comments by saying,
"When I was mayor of Troutdale,"
and one of the most well-informed committees was when in the House we had Representative Hamby, who had been, I think, on a school board in her county in Washington County, and we had the mayor, a former mayor of Eugene, we had former Westland City Councilor Hooley. I had never been on a local government because I I'm not insulting you, but I never wanted to. I only wanted to be in the legislature. It was really helpful to have those enriched background experiences. I don't know what's been happening on this particular issue since in the 15 years that I've been away from the legislature, but are there still session committees and interim committees which deal with local government issues?
There are some. Justice Lindy and I serve on a committee that's examining the state ethics statutes, and that has good representation from local government and state government. So now and then, the Big Look Committee that's looking at land use, another probably good example.
I'm thinking more in terms of, it seems to me that one thing that we may be missing, and it's other areas too, is an ability to develop expertise by legislators. And I guess my chair told us to come to other committees, so maybe I'm talking about the wrong thing in the right place.
I think you're right. As I recall from working in the legislature, that there was a committee on the House Committee on Government Relations, or
Intergovernmental Relations Affairs, right. I think we called it, or state and local.
Perhaps,
government.
Perhaps, you can do some research to find out when that committee expired.
But it seems to me that one of the things that the full commission needs to think about is ways to develop that expertise and keep that expertise and enhance it, and that specific standing committees, maybe they get to be statutory, I don't know what, but in particular areas, and certainly one area, since cities and counties by the Constitution mm-hmm. exist according to what the legislature defines as their roles, whether it's giving them home rule or saying yes you can do this, no you can't. So we are in it all together, very much. So I guess that would be one question for something for us to think about as a recommendation, is that certainly there needs to be some mechanism for legislative expertise development on the roles that cities and counties play in Oregon and the problems that they have. We used to also have, I don't know if it was on every staff measure analysis or if it was only legislative revenue, but there was usually, or specifically on revenue, when there was a fiscal or revenue impact mm-hmm. on cities and counties, and I think I don't know if that's still happening, but I think it's something to consider.
Margaret says it is still happening, that you see that on.
Okay, well maybe we need to look at doing it more of it, or recommending that it be done more. But I guess now I have to ask you questions that you might not want to answer, but I assure you, you're in front of a friendly group, and that is, do you feel that cities and counties are getting enough notice for issues that impact you, for bills that impact you, for legislative hearings and time for input before committees, and would you like to make some comments on that?
Let me start with that, because you'll have before you a copy of a letter that we sent to you in October. And the answer to that is no, especially late in the session. And those of you who have experience know that things start happening with a big sense of urgency late in the session, and things can change without much notice that have dramatic impacts on local government. And we suggest in our letter that there be at least a 48-hour notice requirement for committee hearings with advanced material. Now that
all the way up to the last, the imminent session adjournment.
Yes. Yes.
48 hours.
What happens?
We would never have gotten the lottery bill out if we had to do it that way. But
well, you can understand our concern when things change without notice and a proposal hits.
I'm sorry, it was the video poker bill. Never mind.
Oh, okay. All right. So I don't know that that's the perfect solution, but you asked the question, and I have to say, no, there's not adequate notice. When you've got people who are impacted throughout a state that requires advanced travel plans, when many of our elected officials who are the most effective oftentimes at providing testimony have other lives that they have to rearrange to make it to Salem, it's tough to get them here anyway.
So full time and annual sessions,
Well, that's also addressed in our letter in terms of some limits on annual sessions if you go that direction. So, yes, we would appreciate more notice in the process. I don't know if you have something to add to that.
I think that is very true, that it's difficult towards the end of session, but I also, having served here, recognize the difficulty. And if you don't start having short notice, you can't really pull together those last few committee meetings that you need to have to get to sine die. So I probably wouldn't go with the 48 hours clear up to the end of session. There need to be some time at which you could finally start just kind of pulling committees together pretty quickly.
But only at a time when almost all the other committees are shut down and you're only talking about a very few, that kind of a thing.
Yes, I think that would be very helpful. And then you asked the question about, you know, again, do the cities and counties have kind of more access in terms of are we really paid attention to? And I think I mentioned the ways and means process this past session with the phases, and where I really feel like the county should have been brought in at the beginning during the introductory presentations by the agencies, because, you know, essentially we are
service delivery
part of that.
Mechanism.
Yes. Yeah. And I think the legislature, to give you an example, during the, I think it was the five special sessions between the 01 and the 03 legislature, they had to make a lot of hard choices about human services. Well, that resulted in, I think, 1,800 jobs being cut at counties.
Well,
and I
of course,
think legislators,
that was a loss for the general fund because people weren't getting any.
But that's correct. But I think if you looked at the human service function, there were very few jobs lost at the state level, but a large number of jobs lost at the county level. And I think legislators perhaps weren't aware of that. They weren't necessarily aware of the effects of some of the decisions that they were making. And again, it goes back to education. But if we can't be at the table as an equal partner, we can't deliver that education. Thank you.
Mrs. Lindy.
Thank you. I've been listening to something that this is the first day I've heard about the discussion you've had in the past session. I didn't know about the prior efforts along this. And let me say a couple of preliminary things, and then I want to get back to some questions that Commissioner Herring asked. Preliminary things, first of all, I completely sympathize with you about not being treated as a lobby. I mean, treated as people who are involved in the same total governance. I think you're absolutely in the right to talk about this. But you can't do that and then simultaneously speak about saying, well, we've got some lobbyists. You've got five lobbyists, so they're lobbying because lobbying must make them register as lobbyists. Of course you're going to be treated as another interest group if you rely on lobbyists. You have to convince people that you are not. But that's a different issue, not necessarily before this committee. The same thing is true of some of the executive agencies that are also part of the same governance structure. So in principle, what I've been hearing you say is you want more attention paid. And I'm not sure, I mean, I agree with that. It's a good idea. I'm not sure the structure you've come up with is very well thought out in terms of this. And before I get done with this, I'd also want to make sure we get back to the second suggestion, which nobody's talked about yet, about the opt-out from certain regulations, that kind of flexibility and one-size-fits-all. We haven't got there yet. Let me tell you another example of not having thought things out very well. I just looked at the letter, and there is sort of a routine endorsement of limited sessions and the annual, one annual session being limited to the budget. totally contradicts the other things you want to accomplish. If you want to make sure that there isn't enough time, there won't be enough notice, that things are going to be jammed through under time pressure, that's the way to get there. So I hope you keep an open mind on that. If necessary, take it back to your organization and say, this is not the way to go. This is a dumb idea. Believe me, it's in our, it's my committee. It's not in this committee, but the one I'm looking, working on. And I hope the commission doesn't do that. And it, precisely for the same reasons that you've just indicated, that people, you're going to have more centralized leadership because people are working from against the deadline from the first day of the session. The idea of letting people have an opportunity to go back, deliberate, come back and talk some more is incompatible with this structure. So much for that. I am not sure to get to Commissioner Herring's questions unless you quite understand below this level of getting everybody together and have them pay attention. I mean, beyond that level, what happens? What, in fact, is going to happen? You've mentioned having witnesses, having them come and essentially... Well, you don't usually have members of the legislature and the governor and so on. There was a reference to people... what is it? Others from the leaders' offices. What do you mean? I mean, there are legislators and then there are staff. Now, my question is going to be, if you create something that's an organization with the kind of council structure that you're talking about, are they going to have staff? Is it going to be year-round staff? Is anything going to happen that's specific to that organization during the 3 months between the quarterly sessions? Are they going to have independent research staff? Are you going to rely on legislative staff? What do you have in mind?
Well, and I think you may have raised a good point, that Justice Lindy, that perhaps we haven't totally thought about how this would be staffed. I mean, we did talk about the Governance Council being able to apply for and receive grants and having a separate and distinct an account for this council that would be separate and distinct from the general fund. So we hadn't really talked totally about how to staff this. And I think I may have misspoke when I said representatives of the governor's staff. Well, that clearly wouldn't be another elected official. But in the case of the President of the Senate, Speaker of the House, Senate Minority Leader, House Minority Leader, I at least would envision that their designees, if they didn't want to sit on the council, their designees would in fact be a legislator, not just simply a staff member. But in the case of the governor probably wouldn't want to sit on the council all the time, and he would, in fact, designate a staff member.
Excuse me, let me interrupt you there.
Certainly.
You see, the interesting question is, you can either have a quarterly meeting of principals, or principals delegates who go back and theoretically are going to report, and they say, this is what happened today, and so on. You can call it a conference, you can call it, a quarterly meeting, or whatever, something else, but it's only a way to put something on the agenda and having a discussion among political leaders. So you're talking about essentially getting political leadership attention to what you're doing. Now, that's a very different thing. A council usually, or at least the name is used, I wasn't clear on what we were talking about here, usually is a more ongoing body than may have heads that you can organize any way you like. You can't give a decision power, that's clear. You're not going to have these folks make any decisions of any kind, are you?
Well, again, we did envision them making, perhaps drafting legislation to take
isn't
to the...
decision. That's all right. They can draft. But they can't make a decision because they're mixing...
Correct. Yes, I understand. Yes.
So you can't say, well, we're going to use them as an operating entity. They can't be an operating entity. So that's why I was kind of curious if you would get to the point about who's going to do the work preparing the things that that this council is the agenda and what's going on. Now, you mentioned outside funding. Do you have any state funding in mind?
When we drafted the bill, I don't think we had any state funding in mind.
In my, I came into this late, but my understanding is that we presented a no fiscal impact proposal with this, and that it would be handled with in-kind resources between the league and Association of Oregon Counties, and any resources the state in kind would bring to the table. Of course, it all involves people doing work, but that we were not requesting at the time any state funding.
Okay, let me turn then to the other question I have in mind. I can't read it anymore because the lights came on. But you said something about... can you find the bottom line of that page?
With regards to the administrative rules?
Yeah, that's the one I meant.
Adopting, allowing local governments to adopt variations to administrative rules.
Yes, on that particular one, did you have in mind a local power to simply change them, or would it have to go through, would you send them back to get approved to by the agency under the statute? Because you're talking about a statute, and the statute has some agency that's empowered to go ahead and decide what it means, what the rules ought to be, and how it's going to work. I see no objection to somebody saying, okay, and there'll be a mechanism for people to request an opt-out, and it's okay to have different rules for different units. As a matter of fact, that's my proposal in the other committee for the application of these ethics rules to tiny little unpaid groups of people for whom even filing the reports is already a burden. But it would go back to the agency to sign off on it. Is that what you have in mind, or did you want to have an absolute power to opt out?
No, frankly, I'm going to turn to one of my colleagues on this, because I don't think we've really talked about this. I guess if I would use it as an analogy to what we do in land use, which is certainly not a perfect system, but in fact, the whole concept of Oregon land use, which, again, in my mind hasn't worked all that well, but the concept initially was that there would be broad goals set by the state, and then local government would implement those and would have some flexibility in making the goals and the statutes and the administrative rules fit their particular jurisdiction. But again, every time a local government does one of those comprehensive plans, it has to then go back to the department, the Land Conservation Development Department, to say yay or nay. So if we use that model, then the answer to your question would be yes. But I'm going to turn to see if my colleagues have any thoughts.
Welcome to the table. So,
may I, Mr. Chair, members of the committee? I'm Mike MacArthur, the Executive Director of the Association of Counties. This is an idea in development with the Association of Oregon Counties. It was our thinking that in this particular circumstance with administrative rules, the legislature grant the authority to counties that they by ordinance through public hearing process adopt ordinances which would vary from the department's administrative rules to adapt to local circumstances, and that authority would be granted directly by the legislature to the counties to vary within the scope of the statute and the legislative intent.
And if you couldn't get that, would you settle for going the extra step and saying, and it goes back to the, not the staffs, but to the top, to the level of the agency, and the statute would say that they shall approve any reasonable suggestions, but keeping some sense, because the risk of any simple transfer of power out, not just this program, any program, land use is not the best example, but it's an example, is, of course, that counties don't just do something that in the political interests of all of the citizens they think is the best thing to do. They also are very susceptible to any kind of local economic interest, no matter what the rest of the state may think about accomplishing that particular goal. Huh?
Mr. Justice Lindy,
you understand what I'm talking about?
I understand. I believe what you're saying. And a preferable choice, I think, would be for the legislature itself to make a determination of whether those rules were appropriate or not, rather than go to the department.
Who would have the burden on that?
Legislative council.
But, see, no, you didn't mean legislative council. You mean go back on the floor and get another debate as to whether to override the county.
Mr. Chair, I believe that the legislature could empower a group of legislators to review these ordinances adopted by counties. If the department objected to the rule that was adopted by the county, come back to the legislature, the granting authority.
That's questionable. It's constitutionally questionable whether you can do that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying that's not an open and shut issue at all. That looks very much like the legislative committee veto, which courts around the country have invalidated.
Well, Mr. Chair, Justice Lindy, as Mr. MacArthur said, this is just an idea that we are just beginning to look at. I mentioned land use with some trepidation because, quite frankly, I think that's not a good example. One of the major cities in Yamhill County has just spent 12 years in a process to expand their urban growth boundary, largely because the department kept sending it back to them, try again, try again, try again. So I guess I'd be a little worried about a process that would allow the state agency to basically keep local government in limbo as long as currently happens in the land use systems. We will go back and think more about how to bring this forward. I think you've raised some good questions with regard to it.
No, I'm sympathetic with that delay concern. That's a serious concern.
Other questions from the panel? As I said, the staff did provide us with a listing of all the states that have similar panels, and we'll be reviewing that, and would encourage the counties and the cities in the coming weeks to share with us any further thoughts you have or additions to what you proposed, Mr. MacArthur.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I advise the committee to look back at the governance council that existed informally for about 2 years under leadership of President Durfler in the Senate. The research was done by his staff originally. The Governance Council was convened by Senator Durfler and functioned here for some time until Senator Durfler left and there's no longer an impetus to keep going.
Okay, Mr. Taylor, you'll provide us with some background on that. Commissioner Boswell. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Back to the basic question of why do we need this council and what would it do? I think that we need the council authorized by statute because if it isn't, it will fall under the law of unintended consequences, missed intentions. LCDC has two advisory committees by statute. I've been a member of both of them. So we do participate in that matter. What I see in this unique in this one is this is a governance council. This is not a land use council, it's not a water use council, it's not a transportation council. I don't think that there is an entity in the state of Oregon that's addressing governance as a way to approach solving these problems, as a way to bring all units of government into the ways and means process, which we can only do by way of the legislature. There's no other process that can consider the flexibility needed in administrative rules. To me, that would be the subject matter of this governance council, is governance issues, and by way of addressing those in terms of resources and flexibility meeting local needs, I think that's why we need a governance council.
Thank you very much, Commissioners. And Ms. Bryant.
Thank you very much.
Next on our agenda, one of the topics before this committee is the public access to the legislature, whether the public has the proper access, enough access, and we have a few experts on that here to testify us today are Margaret Knoll, the president of the League of Women Voters, Paul Cosgrove and Ellen Lowe, who are experienced lobbyists here in Salem, and Peter Wong with the Statesman Journal, who will give us the media viewpoint. Yes, we'll get you last, Peter. We'll start with Margaret's here representing the public viewpoint, I guess, as a League of Women Voters.
Thank you.
We appreciate that the League has been with us, this committee and commission, at all of our meetings, and thank you for doing that.
Yes, thank you. Chair Tim Tripp and members of the committee, for the record, I am Margaret Knoll. I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. Thank you so much for asking me to testify to you today. We usually begin our testimony on any subject by saying that the League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. And so what you are addressing in this particular meeting right now is our mission. We care very much, as you have pointed out, about what this committee is doing, and we thank you very much for your dedication. This is very important to us, and we think to the citizens of Oregon. Coincidentally, this is Sunshine Week, and I'm sure that the people, the members of the media, know that. Throughout the country, the League of Women Voters is celebrating open government, and we are trying to inform citizens of their rights. The League believes that the citizens have a right to know, the governmental bodies must protect the citizens' right to know by giving adequate notice of proposed actions, holding open meetings, and making public records accessible. And, of course, Oregon's 1973 open meetings law does just that. Today I'm basing my testimony on the experience of many League members who've spent many more hours, many more days in this particular building than I have, and so I am drawing on their experience and their recommendations. And I'm also drawing on the experience of the League in being a group that tries to communicate with the public. So I will share with you some of the things we've learned as we have tried to communicate. I want to begin by mentioning some procedures that tend to shut citizens out of the legislative process just as bills are being finalized. And one of these has been mentioned earlier today. It's the process of budget notes and amendments to budget bills. According to the Oregon Constitution, budget notes or putting any kind of policy into budget bills is unconstitutional. And that's in Article 9, Section 7. Policies need to be openly debated with opportunities for citizens to testify. And we ask that this commission recommend that budget notes and other policy requirements be omitted from budget bills. Another way in which citizens can be shut out of the legislative process is when a legislative committee adopts the recommendations of a work group or a task force without holding a public hearing on those recommendations. Now, we understand that work groups sometimes do need to work in private while they go through their deliberations, but when they come to the point where they are making recommendations to a committee, then we think there should be a public hearing on those recommendations before they are put into a bill.
And has there been times when that has not happened?
Yes. There have been times when the recommendations of the task force were immediately put into a bill and were not open to a public hearing where the public could testify.
An example would be?
I would have to ask, as again, people who have been here a lot more, but Paula Crane is with me, and perhaps later she can respond to that.
Yes.
She's our Citizen Access Chair, and I'm very grateful to her. In addition, I have been told by Kathy Eaton, who is another governance chair, that very often the composition of work groups is not representative, that they can be put together very hastily, and that, therefore, we think that the work group should represent the full spectrum of opinion and of Oregonians. Kathy has worked on some work groups that did that, and of course there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of debate back and forth, but she thinks that the results, when you have a real diversity in the work group, the results are better.
As you communicate with colleagues from other states, do you find that the Oregon legislature is more accessible, less accessible than other legislatures?
My own experience is that the Oregon legislature is quite accessible in many ways. But I think these two particular examples are cases where there could be improvement. And there could be improvement in other ways, too. I have a list here, and I'm not going to go through everything, of what I've observed it takes.
Your testimony will be made part of the committee record. So
yes, I do understand. It takes a lot of work and a lot of patience for citizens to participate in the legislative process. A lot of time. And I think it takes more than most ordinary citizens are willing to devote to it. Even for us, there are barriers. We try to represent the ordinary citizen. I'd like to speak first to the barriers of distance and time that keep citizens from testifying. Legislative committees have tried to address these problems when they have let people who come from more than 100 miles away testify first, or when they hold legislative hearings around the state, which some committees do and did do in the 2005 session. When there is a hearing, especially when it's being held around the state, I've observed, and I've been, because I've been to some of those hearings, that the committee chair is trying to be very respectful of invited testimony, of the people who've come for invited testimony or of expert testimony, have asked those people to speak first. And many times those people are the ones who have the access to the Capitol. They can come and lobby at the Capitol, and yet they get priority over the citizens who've taken the time to come to a hearing, especially those that are devoted especially to hearing the citizens. If you go around the state, you're trying to hear what the citizens have to say. So we would recommend that you please recommend to the legislature that they hear the citizens first, or at least, as you have done with your agenda today, have a time on the agenda that's very specific for citizen testimony, so that people know and they don't have to stay through hours and hours of invited testimony waiting to testify.
Mr. Chair?
Sure. Proceed.
I don't recall that phrase being something that we use. Maybe we just called it something different when I was here, or didn't call it anything at all, but did it anyhow. I don't know, Mr. Chair, but how does that operate now? If
I mean,
someone could explain it to me a little.
Are you talking about my
the invited testimony?
Well, concept. I am an invited. I am testifying to you today because I was invited to come.
Okay.
Obviously, there's
sure.
This is a difficult thing for a chair. They may feel that it's respectful to ask the people who are invited to testify first. I'm saying that in some cases it's really respectful to ask the citizens to testify first, but to make it clear what time during the agenda each group will be able to testify.
Administrator Taylor, who ran a committee during the legislature, is there a common uniform practice for committees, or is it ad hoc?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in terms of invited testimony, especially during session, you'll find that a chair might want to set up a discussion about a particular bill or particular issue, and they'll invite the proponents or opponents to come kind of set the stage, lay out some of the issues, and then hear the public testimony afterwards. I've worked with chairs who try to take all of the pro testimony first, followed by con, or all of the opponent testimony first, followed by proponents. But then I've also had chairs kind of go between pro, con, pro, con, pro, con. But again, the invited testimony is basically to get those people who have worked on the bill or who are going to have to staff whatever recommendation comes out of it, get them on board first to set the stage for everybody else who might have a comment about it.
I can understand that.
Is there a uniform rule about the 100 miles, or is that too ad hoc?
On the witness registration, and it does say that if you're traveling more than 100 miles one way, that the chair generally tries to take those people first after they, again, set the stage of whatever the issue is. There are some people who interpret that as a 100-mile round trip, and I personally have tried to identify to the chair that Portland isn't necessarily 100 miles away. But on some issues, you just have more testimony than others. I think it just kind of depends. And we will constantly get notes from the audience. I have an appointment at such and such time, whatever. It also depends on whether these people are submitting written testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Cease?
It seems, I don't know, maybe we should think about it, and I don't know if this is the process committee or this committee, but it is a public access issue, and that is, it makes sense to me if committees have somebody who can explain the
the bill and the intent of it and then let everybody else have at it. And leave, you know, have a short time. Maybe it just goes back to some training in committee management as well for legislators about how you operate a committee. I was lucky. I had two very experienced legislators when I was a freshman and was able to observe how, and they seemed to deal with it in a fair way. Maybe some training issues as well come out of this.
Representative Boone, you still with us?
Yeah, I've got something to say.
Sure, go ahead.
Go ahead, Debbie. You want me to wait a little bit?
No, go ahead.
Okay, well, I've been making some notes here, and I just want to start with saying that, you know, it is a process, and it has to have some rules, some parameters to follow, because generally the committees run 2 hours, and they're run on a schedule that meshes with the schedule of other committees, and members on those committees belong to other members and other committees, or they have, this is all during session, of course, or they have session, legislative session, and particularly near the end of the session when we'll have multiple legislative sessions, you know, House and Senate sessions during the workday that are ongoing among the committees. So I want to say a couple of things about that. We did, and I don't know who was testifying for the LEAP, but he's correct in saying we did take an extraordinary measures to hold hearings around the state, and that's no easy feat, as Marjorie can tell you, and Kelly. There's a lot of prep time and prep work to do. It costs money, and it is convenient for the people in those areas. In some cases, that's what we wanted to do, was get try to go out to the people. We did that during session, and we do it during interim. The committee work and the legislative work takes time, and that's part of the nature of the work. And a lot of constituents don't understand that, and they think they can just go down to Salem at any point and testify for their bill. What I did with people, and I like to think most members do, is they work with their constituents to manage legislation that's a bill that someone's asked for or something someone's interested in. And so testifying becomes part of that management, and they're alerted to when hearings are, and they're told this is how it works, and this, you know, and this is how we do it. District chairs give examples. Representative Dalto often ran the committees long, and we were late to session, or we'd go up to session and come back, and he would stay and listen to all of the people who wanted to testify, give everyone a chance. One of the things that happens, and I know this is particularly frustrating on a big bill or an important bill to somebody where there's a large group of people wanting to have something to say about it, people tend to go on and on. Sometimes they'll have 2 or 3 pages of testimony they want to read. Sometimes the chairs will limit the time to 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, or they'll say, if you have something to say and it's been said 10 times before, can you sum it up, or, you know, wrap it up quickly, and even, you know, we appreciate the fact you've come, but it's, you know, if you're, we'll mark it, and you, don't worry, you'll be counted as a pro or a con or whatever. They try to manage the committee that way so that everybody does have a chance, and more importantly, to allow some time at the end for the committee members to ask questions so that they can be sure that they understand the testimony, and that the people testifying have a chance to qualify it if they've been taken wrong. And I guess I just have to say that Representative Gilman did the same thing. I've heard him listen very patiently to people just read preparatory stuff that was on the form letter, and, you know, scores of people testifying and saying the same thing over and over again. And the chairs that I had were very, very considerate. I have heard those stories, but, you know, I've never experienced it as a legislator. I experienced it myself in 1985 when someone was rude to me on, you know, during a committee hearing. But I don't see that behavior. I haven't seen that in the committees I've served on. And I think that people are receiving a lot of orientation and training from both the clerk's office. I can't say the same for the Senate side because I don't reside there. But I'm pretty sure Judy Hall does just as good a job as Ramona in outlining how things work. And I think that it's incumbent on the public, when they want to be part of the process, to locate their representative and senator and, you know, connect with them and say, I'm interested in this and I want to be a part of this, and help, let them help manage it. Because otherwise people will get a bad taste in their mouth, and then that it's not accessible to people, and that's how we get the bad reputation.
Thank you, Representative. Yes. Margaret?
Well, Chair Chimchuk and Representative Boone and members of the committee, I want to say that I did not want to imply that the committee chairs are rude. I think they do have a very difficult balance that they have to work with there, to try to listen to the members of the public who've come to testify, to try to figure out how to be fair to everyone. And I was just recommending trying to make the committee schedule in such a way that people don't get frustrated and go home before they have a chance to testify. The 48-hour notice has already been mentioned, so I'm going to kind of skip over that, except to say that we would support it, too, as long in the session as possible. I think it was stopped 2 months before the end of the session last time. The other issue of last-minute amendments, I think, is a difficult, tricky issue, where sometimes legislators walk into a hearing room and even they haven't seen the amendments. And certainly for members of the public who have come to testify on the previous version of the bill, this can be a difficult issue. And I have put some recommendations into my written testimony about trying to make it as clear as possible what the changes are and what their effects are, perhaps having a cover sheet that's also posted on the door to notify people about exactly the content of the amendments. And I know sometimes these amendments are very last minute. So whatever could be done. Our league members use all kinds of techniques to try to learn about the information on bills and to know about the different agendas. And it includes connections with people here in the Capitol. We really appreciate the committee administrators because they are wonderful with helping us, but of course they're not available to everyone. And of course the being able to sign up and get for agendas and get them online, I think these are important tools. I just think we need to make citizens more aware, and that's where I want to address the website, because that's something that's another one of the sets of proposals, I think proposal 71, that you're looking at today. On the website, on what would be the right-hand side, is a very pale set of links that starts with the citizen's guide. I don't know if you can picture the
legislative kind of meeting. We had a demonstration of the website. So.
The citizen's guide is a wonderful resource. I think it should be a lot more prominent on the website. It has some great information in it. I think there should be some more information in it. I think that particularly from the citizen's guide, you should be able to sign up for agendas online or to sign up for emailed agendas. And there are some cases where the emailed agendas don't include an opportunity to get agendas to all the different committees, particularly the revenue committees and the fiscal committees. So I think there are some things that could be done with the Citizen's Guide to make it much more accessible, and so that people could learn very quickly how to deal with the legislature when they went to the legislative homepage. I do want to say that the video that's on that citizen's guide for how to testify is excellent and really worth featuring. We, of course, have experience with trying to generate public interest in the matters that come before the legislature, and that's also the job of the media. But one of the things we've done in doing that is to try to use a lot of illustrations and use really good formatting. We have, in the last 5 or 6 years, changed the format of our voter's guide. And when we do publications, I forgot to bring the one that was to show you, but we have pictures in them and graphs and all kinds of things to try to help people understand. And we think that perhaps this would be helpful on the legislative website and in legislative publications, too. And finally, on the last page of, not the appendix where I put lots of other thoughts, but on the last page of this testimony is something called Guidelines to Writing in Accessible Language. We are working with a whole group of people who work with voters with disabilities for this coming election cycle to try to help people with disabilities understand the election issues and understand what candidates are like. And this was something that was created for candidates, these guidelines for writing in accessible language. I think we could use some of that in explaining some of the legislative bills, too. It's mostly just use common words and write in simple sentences with one idea per sentence. One out of every five adults reads at a fifth grade level, and that's shocking when you first learn it. And many of them are perfectly intelligent. Some of them grew up with other languages as their native language. But it's really worth trying to reach them.
Commissioner Herring?
Excuse me for interrupting, but are you making that as a recommendation in terms of legislation? Do you want bills to be written?
No. I think that's almost impossible, but because I agree with
you. Wouldn't be such a good idea. I mean, I think it's a great idea.
It would be. You know, I think the summary, there is a summary on every bill.
Well, no, most of them it's not. I mean, there's a summary that says relating to such and so, which doesn't mean anything to anybody.
Yeah. I think, isn't it beyond that, Marjorie Taylor? Isn't there something that's a little bit more than...
There's a little paragraph at the top of the bill that describes as many portions of the bill as possible, not all.
Well, without... Yeah. Meaning to disagree, I mean, many bills that I've looked at, looking for exactly that paragraph, the paragraph wasn't there.
Well,
it says relating to such and so.
And Commissioner Herring and Chair Turk, I would recommend that there be a paragraph there in accessible language explaining what the effect of the bill is. Just as I think there should be something that explains in accessible language what the effect of the amendments are.
Let me just...
Yes.
One short comment, if I may, on that point.
Now we're in trouble.
No. It is, as you know, the ballot measure short summaries, there are two problems. One is that they constantly get litigated because they may not accurately state what the content is, and people say, well, you're going to react to this summary statement. The flip side of that is that if you don't disregard them, they become part of the apparent meaning of the bill, and judges go nuts about whether they're not part of the legislation, but they seem to explain something which the current Oregon court, not my day, says you can't look at. You can't look to see what they thought they were doing. You just look at the operative words. You're going to buy a terrible problem there if you take those seriously, those summaries.
Commissioner Lindy and Chair Chumchuk, I realize that this is something that we are currently struggling with. We are, right now, we are working on an easy-to-read voting guide, which is directed at fifth-grade reading level. And when we get to the general election, I mean, thank goodness there are no ballot measures on this particular primary election, but when we get to the general election, we will be trying to explain every ballot measure in simple, accessible language.
We'd love to leave it to you. You should do it.
In the Supreme Court, I understand that when the court is working with this and when you have legal issues, you have to be extremely careful. And I do understand what you're saying there. Yes. I have also included an appendix that expresses some other issues of having hearings around the state and so on, and I'd be glad to speak more about those. But I think I've spent a long time, and I want to thank you very much. I also want to say legislators, of course, are the people who connect with their own constituents, and they do need also to use every tool at their disposal to meet with constituents and correspond and communicate with their constituents.
Justice Lindy, you have one more question?
Yeah, I have one question for you.
Yes.
That's not about what the commission should do, but about what the league should do. If somebody in a legislative committee or chair or whatever wants to find the league's position on a particular idea, At what level can an answer be given? That's to say, this isn't something that the League has previously studied, hasn't developed through its institutional membership mechanism some kind of, which takes much too long. So by the time an issue is, by the time you've studied it, it's passé. But if you want an answer to a contemporary, current issue, how can the League answer?
Well, Commissioner Lindy and Chair Tomczyk and members of the committee, I do agree the League process is very slow. It takes us 2 years to study an issue. We try to develop positions based on those studies that are as broad as possible so that when we get to specific issues, they will fall under that broad position. There are occasions where we have not studied even the broad issue, and we cannot comment on it. We can educate people about it, and we try to, but if we have not come to member agreement, and there are some issues that we have actually studied where we have not come to member agreement, and we can't comment on those either. Not in terms of action. Fine with educating. We're fine with showing both sides of the issue, all of that, but we...
What I'm looking forward to, of course, is that this commission is going to have a large number of recommendations, some of which may be controversial. And then you won't be able to take a position on them. Unless you have something already. But not about excess. You've studied excess forever.
Mm-hmm.
As far as government structure is concerned, I'm not so sure.
You're very right. There are some things that you may recommend that we will have to stay neutral.
Thank you for...
As individuals, we can get behind something, but not as the League.
Thank you for being here today and again for all you've done throughout commission's meetings. Ellen Lowe and Paul Cosgrove are familiar faces in the Capitol building, both members of the Capitol Club, and welcome today, Ellen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the commission. I'm Ellen Lowe, and you will find me in the Capitol Club directory. I spent about 25 years, I think, in this building as a citizen advocate before I finally decided that the grassroots I had wouldn't turn brown if indeed I joined the club. I would like to just comment on some things that came up during the local government proposal, if I may. And one was, I recall that the first, I would say, major casualty at the University of Oregon as a result of ballot measure 5 was the disappearance of the Bureau of Governmental Research and Service. Herman Carley was there for years. In fact, he was my first boss 54 years ago.
My husband once was employed there.
And also then Ken Tolinar. But when they were talking about the local government relationships, I kept thinking of the great work that was done there. And the fact that Oregon now does not have really that kind of body that's available with sound, good information for everyone involved in public policy. And so I offer that. The other... Jane Cease mentioned Senator Otto. I remember when Senator Otto was a representative and chair of the local government committee, because Chair Tomczyk, that was when I first had a lengthy conversation with your father as mayor of Greensport.
You've got a good memory.
Because as president of the League of Oregon Cities, he invited me to go along on the trip. And we went all over the state. We were in Eastern Oregon, Central Oregon, the coast, Southern Oregon, the valley, with that local government committee. and meeting with people who were in the trenches in all those places. And I think it was something that had great value. And so I am one who really does believe, even though in a way it may be cumbersome, that it is important when committees are considering something that really does have some statewide implications, where there may be variations in different parts of the state, that the committees go out there and do some visiting.
Do you recall, Ellen, when the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee went away? So I remember Bill Markham was on it one year, and you were on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you remember when it...
No, it seemed to me that it was here into the early 90s, and what the reason for the demise, I don't know, but I do know that it was a valuable service, and I would hope that might be something that would be on your list to look at, because the folks from the counties and cities talked about governance, and I think the Bureau did more than just... I worked on taxes when I was there for Herman, and just began some things in planning. But I think there were a lot of things involving governance that were part of what they did. I should say, as part of my background, that the first thing I was involved in was 55 years ago as a young Republican, meeting with young Democrats and the League of Women Voters on reapportionment, which we finally got on the ballot by initiative and passed in 52. And so in many ways, I think it's somewhat contradictory that one of the greatest contributions to representative democracy in Oregon really came via initiative. And then I was sort of busy doing other things for 12 years, and then I spent 25 years really as never being paid for any of the advocacy, was action chair. Once for the League of Women Voters, also tax chair, and was here and sometimes representing boards and commissions or the city of Salem and the League of Oregon Cities. But I think that because I really was part of the grassroots, it was easy for me to be somewhat sensitive when I did become part-time public policy director for Ecumenical Ministries, to be very sensitive to making sure that I didn't just function as a messenger for people who needed a legislative remedy for something that was wrong, but I tried to create opportunities for them to participate in the process. And so that's why notification, public hearings, all those things in my book are extremely important. I appreciated the 48 hours last time, but I will say that when you're trying to arrange transportation for folks to come from not just the valley, but other places, you need more than 48 hours. And so it's so helpful, particularly in budget issues, where you are able to have advance notice, because I know at the food bank, it means that we often found ourselves arranging for childcare, for transportation, for time away from an hourly job. These sorts of things you don't arrange in 48 hours, but at least that ought to be a limitation. One of the things that was just mentioned was about the description, and I'm trying to remember, you talked about accessible language. On my notes, I wrote having what is being proposed written in Oregon language or United States. And this is where I do want to say that you have as your committee staff someone that I remember through the years being exceptional. And so that when the chair would ask for, and in this last session, for an explanation, you'd get it in what I would call Oregon or United States. And so, and
that's why Administrator Taylor's making the big bucks here on the panel. We're all volunteers, but she gets.
Yep. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I wish she were being paid much more. And I do need to say that I think there is that the process is served by having full-time, well-steeped staff. And if we go to annual sessions, maybe that will be easier. But even if you don't have annual sessions, with the interim committee process and this sort of thing, and with such things as the demise of the Bureau, I think the Oregon legislature is being very, very foolish in not beefing up their administrative and research staff, so that they can have the background then to be the translator for the folks that I bring to the Capitol. And it's critical, and I just, there are some places maybe you can cut the budget. I don't think that is one of them. And when you start looking at length of sessions, I think you'd all be much better served by having a whole bunch of Marjorie Taylors around.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Some other things. I don't know if I mentioned the video conferencing in order to be in touch with other parts of the state, and there perhaps library system could really be your access of making that happen. And sometimes city council chambers have that kind of capacity, or maybe a local system. It's been mentioned about the invited testimony. I think that is something where hopefully you would have the kind of chair that would be able to make sure that the invited testimony was aimed at setting the stage for what is being proposed. I would not exclude some of that kind of invited testimony, because I have been in the position through the years that once I have sat and really listened to what was being proposed, my response, my testimony then has been changed. And so again, I see it as a time saver. People from a distance coming first. I know that those 23 years I lived in Salem, there were often times when an extra bedroom was made available to someone in order to take advantage of that, being able to testify first. Work sessions. To have a public hearing, have questions raised, and then go immediately in the work session or do it the next day is really not giving time then for public response to what they have heard. And so I see the need for a time lapse between the hearing and the work sessions. And oftentimes in work session, I think it's helpful when committee chairs actually ask the Paul Cosgroves to come up and sit at the here and to be able to respond, because sometimes you and your work groups put everything together, other times there still needs that ability. I spend most of my time at the other end of the hall. MF in ways and means. Mm-hmm. And there were things that happened this last session where I think F was the right letter. because the prioritization process in the subcommittee that I observed only dealt with things that were the line items within the governor's budget. And so rather than becoming an exercise for thinking outside the box, it was probably the most limiting thing I've ever observed. I would like to see more contact and communication between the substantive committees and the Ways and Means subcommittees, so that the human service committees at both the House and the Senate level need to have some time where they are being briefed and vice versa by the subcommittee. And that is something that hasn't been happening lately. And there were some issues at the very end of the last session dealing with the health plan that I think purely, very clearly demonstrated that there hadn't been that kind of communication. And it was one of those times where I found myself really testifying about the process.
Commissioner Pryor.
Could you give us kind of an explanation of what the differences you saw this last session from several years ago, say 10 years ago or something?
Well, it, Commissioner Pryor, this last time we were doing it supposedly in phases, where, if my memory, correct me if I'm wrong, where we started out at 60,000 feet or 50,000, and then we went down to 25,000 perhaps. And then we were supposed to have gotten down to the ground, and we never made it to the ground, in my judgment. There were some, and now it depended on, I should say it depended on which subcommittee, because I actually appeared and followed three of the different subcommittees, and Human Service was the one that never made it to the ground. Some of the others did, and perhaps it's the complexity in Human Services where they need to relook how they do that one. I'm not certain, but we used to start with the agency presentation, and then we'd go into really in-depth exploration within Human Services of each of the clusters. We didn't get there this time, and so you had public testimony before you had the discussion at the subcommittee level and the deliberation and even sort of tentative draft proposals or direction. The other thing which I'll say in relationship to budget is that I know you have in one of these you're talking about closed caucuses or open caucuses, and I need to be up front that I think one of the worst things that happened in this last session was, in my judgment, partly a result of having an open caucus, at least at the Senate level. And that was the agreement for 12.393, the budget agreement that was reached 2 months into the session before you had had any of the real testimony in Ways and Means. And so rather than thinking outside the box, it put them in one. And then I am quite convinced that at least the Senate caucus, I can't imagine some of the people I know who are part of that caucus, if you had had a closed caucus, they would have had an opportunity to question what was happening. And so you, this small group, which I never have understood how they were able to maneuver all of this, but they came to this agreement, and it wasn't the public that was kept out that was the worst part. I think it was their fellow legislators who were excluded from the process, those that I sort of like to trust with representative democracy. The other thing I'd say, that those who have closed caucuses, if I want to know what's going on, I've always found out within a few minutes anyway.
Small building, so yeah. So.
And so, so that is, and I look at the League of Women Voters, where I know if I were still action chair, I wouldn't have been able to accept what I just said about the caucus.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Zeese.
I'd like to thank Ellen for those comments. I agree with you. A caucus isn't really where a formal testimony and decision-making process take place, and it seems to me it's more like a management team, and I don't think you can possibly develop the kinds of relationships and understanding and respectful relationships unless you have some place like that where you can get to know one another without, pardon me, without the press sitting there, because legislators do not behave like themselves when the press is sitting around in the caucus. They behave unnaturally, and they need to have a place where it's safe to even get mad at each other and have a big fight and then get all back together and make up and figure out where they might like to try to go. And I think that it's been a real damage to the whole thing. And I'm afraid my senator is going to be really in disagreement with me on this, but I'll keep trying to do what I can to influence her, too.
Just to show you the miracles of modern communications, I just got an email on my BlackBerry from a lobbyist friend who said it was 1993 when the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee was expired. So there you go.
Somebody who was there. Yeah. So my memory was pretty close.
Mr. Cosgrove, yeah, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Timchek and members of the Commission. I agree with much of what has been said, especially by Ellen, only because she was kind enough to share with me her notes before.
That'll be a test later.
I'm going to just touch on four topics, one of which is, I recognize, not exactly within the purview of this committee, but that's session length. And let me tell you why I believe it adversely, our current process of the session length of 7.5 to 8 months, adversely affects public participation. I had the good fortune, or the bad fortune, whichever you would like to call it, to spend a good deal of time in Olympia in the last couple of months. And as you know, Olympia, State of Washington, runs its legislature far differently from ours in a variety of ways, but one of which is a time-limited session with very specific crossover and cutoff dates. What that meant is everyone who had an interest in the bills in play knew that the time for that interest to be expressed and the decision-making time period for those bills was a defined period. It wasn't an issue where this might come up in January, it might come up in August, it might come up in March and May. Mm-hmm. It was going to come up in this period of time. And for those people, either who are trying to follow the legislature process as individuals, or for that matter, those people who have hired people or have volunteers within this building, that defined time period increases the ability that they will have meaningful input. So I think from that perspective, public participation could be increased by doing some things with session times, cutoffs, and crossover dates. My second...
And before you leave that question,
sure.
May I ask a question, please?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, you can have those set times fixed regardless of session length, can't you?
Yes, Commissioner Lindy, I think you can, although I think that it is perhaps more difficult to enforce. We, in fact, have crossover dates that are announced by presiding officers in nearly every session, certainly mm-hmm. in the last 5 or 10.
You can put them in the rules or whatever you want to do, but the question of, it doesn't, there's no connection between that and the session length by itself. As a standalone issue.
Well, although if you have consistent and enforced crossover times, it drives a session length because
that's
there's nothing.
That's something.
The issues have either proceeded or died, and I think
that's something else. Though that which drives which is what I'm asking you about. I agree with you. If you have the crossover time, it may shorten the session.
I just to put a fine point on that, or any point on that, I think a defined session length without crossover times may be the worst of all possible worlds. But I think the combination of the two can be very helpful in terms of improving public participation. My second issue has to do with budget and the Ways and Means process. As Ellen mentioned, we handle the Ways and Means process in a different manner than we do the policy committees, and there's some good reason for that. But in my judgment, most of the important public policy decisions made by the legislature these days is either made in the Ways and Means Committee or made in the Revenue Committees, because what drives public policy is how we spend money and how we raise money to a far greater degree than I think ever was true in the past. And therefore, the Ways and Means process, I think, needs special attention in terms of how to get greater public involvement to it. I think we need to do better, and I have great admiration for the fiscal staff. We need to do better about having budget reports out earlier rather than out the day of the work session. And I recognize they're under constant mm-hmm. change, and that's a very difficult, that's an easy thing to say and a very difficult mm-hmm. thing to accomplish. But I think those budget reports and what has happened with the various allocations of resources are, in fact, incredibly important. And I think the distinction between what's budget and what's policy is, in many ways, less meaningful than it used to be in another respect. By the very fact that the legislature appropriates $100,000 for juvenile diabetes testing, that is, in effect, a policy decision in a budget bill. And the only way to get around that is to say we appropriate to the department X billion dollars and they can spend it how they choose. In this day and age, we don't seem to think that's an appropriate way to budget. I agree it's not appropriate, but we really can't keep policy issues out of budget bills. They are a necessary part of budget bills because those decisions drive policy. My third comment has to do with the website and other sort of technology access issues. I know that there have been folks, and Ms. Taylor is one of them, who have taken a look at other ways to, beyond the ones that we've implemented so far, to have what's happening in the building accessible to people outside. And we have, I think, a pretty good system of web-based access. But we could do better, I think, if we had the closed-circuit TV that's available in the building available on a more broad basis. Along the model, again, not to use too much of our neighbor to the north is the best example because they have their own problems. But they have a channel, a TVW, that, in fact, broadcasts mm-hmm. for those people who don't have easy web access, broadcasts legislative hearings. And with respect to the website also, I think we could do a better job of having the documents that are really part of the decision-making be available on the website sooner. Mm-hmm. Amendments are secret until they're revealed by their drafter, but once they've been sent to the committee for discussion, they need to be up on the website. We don't get that kind mm-hmm. of information outside the building to the people who are watching mm-hmm. us until the bill is engrossed. Mm-hmm. That's after the actions happen. Certainly once those amendments have been discussed publicly, it seems to me they ought to be available on the website. And then my fourth comment is on field hearings. I agree that it's important to go around the state, especially to get input about what the different implications of policies or budget decisions are. But I think last session we did it right when we did the budget hearings around the state, where the same issues were discussed at various locations to get input from various people. We didn't do it very well with policy committees, where we would have, in some cases, the only hearing on an issue in some small town somewhere far from the Capitol. And in some cases, we would have the work session where the final amendments were drafted also in some small town away from the Capitol. I think when the final decision on policy bills is made, it needs to be made in the Capitol building. Right. That's where the people expect the people's visits to happen. I think it's great to get input around the state, but I think the decision-making needs to happen here in this building where everybody knows that's where it's supposed to happen. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I would just leave you with those four thoughts.
Thank you. Any questions, committee members?
Thank you. One.
Oh, raise your hand.
You mentioned the possibility of broadcasting legislative proceedings, hearings, I gather, or committee meetings mainly, right? Committee meetings particularly?
Yes. And four sessions.
And Washington State does that?
Yes, and of course when you're moving to closed circuit TV, you're making choices just like our video feed on the web is, where there's only one thing being broadcast at a time, but they also do like we do on our video feeds to the web. They take delay and they'll have the floor session of the House at one time and followed by the floor session of the Senate, even though those are happening concurrently at the same time.
What do you know about the audience for that program? I mean, what is the size of the audience? Does anybody, I mean, they broadcast it. Does anybody pay attention? Is anybody watching?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. I know that some of the committee staff here has been looking at TVW, and I don't know if they know the answer to that question as well. It's certainly avidly watched by people all over the city of Olympia in state office and in cafeterias.
Well, you have to wonder whether any work goes on during part of that. But the thing is that we've had in Oregon this experiment with OPAN. And every once in a while, channel surfers around Oregon will come across a program on OPAN, and there's some guy at a dais like this talking, and you have no idea what it's all about. And it's just amusing in the way of in trying to figure out what's going on. Beyond that, it really doesn't have much utility because there's no background, there's no summary, there's nothing. I mean, you don't understand anything. Unless you're one of the in crowd, you already know all these people and you know the issues. I'm just wondering whether that is all that useful.
I'm sorry, I can't tell you how.
Mr. Taylor?
Jumping at the bait here. Your facilities committee has addressed and actually endorsed a recommendation regarding the Oregon Channel, which is similar to OPAN, but expanded, and that the Oregon Channel will be a pilot project starting next session, where they're going to try to have gavel-to-gavel coverage of various committee meetings, floor sessions, and other public affairs sort of issues, and it's going to be like C-SPAN, but for Oregon. So it's tracking on the TV Washington that Mr. Cosgrove is talking about. But instead of catching 1 hour's worth of public commission on the Oregon legislature as we're up against Oprah some random afternoon, we'll see the whole meeting. At least that's what they're trying to trend towards. And OPAN is merely a block of programming. It's not a channel. It's just a program. So we're looking into it, and you'll hear
American
about it.
American Idol, watch out in the ratings.
You'll hear about it.
OPAN is coming.
So that's a scary thought.
Judge Breyer?
Mr. Cosgrove, what do you follow particularly in legislative session?
Commissioner Pryor, I am a generally considered a business lobbyist. I represent a number of companies, a number of trade associations, although I also represent some nonprofit organizations. I've been doing it for about 25 years.
You mentioned public policy at least three times in the things that you said here today. Could you give me some kind of an example of if I wanted to know what Oregon's public policy was related to some business issue, would I have to plow through a budget document to try to figure out what the public policy is, or is it, could I find it someplace?
That's a difficult question. I think it doesn't probably reside in one location. However, to the extent, and I think that this is what I was referring to, and maybe I didn't make myself clear, our budget documents, which have about six or seven lines for a relatively large department with very big numbers on them, are backed up by a very large budget report that talks about, of this money, we expect juvenile diabetes testing will be doing this, and this cuts this and adds that. That's the public policy document that I was talking about that is, I think, driven by that six or seven line bill that has a few dollar signs in it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll make just a comment to
sure.
the committee. I've been looking at rural policy now for about 6 years and trying to find it. And interestingly enough, the European Union has a lot of stated policy. And if you start digging around, you see that their fiscal decisions follow policy. It's pretty easy to see. We don't have much. Just thought I'd throw that out there.
Thank you, Ian, all three of you.
Thank you.
Peter Wong with the States and Journals here. He's a longtime journalist. Covers this building. Peter, I expect your story tomorrow to say in mesmerizing testimony. Peter Wong.
No, Mr. Chairman, you will not expect that.
Impress the committee with his brilliant...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Peter Wong.
What happened to
I'll get to that, Commissioner Herring. Peter Wong, Capitol Bureau reporter of the Statesman Journal and president of the Oregon Legislative Correspondents Association.
Thank you, Justice Lindy, for being with us today.
Mr. Chairman, I learned early on in my career, even before I became a journalist, I worked briefly in Congress and had the privilege to 32 years ago to testify to a subcommittee at the United States House. Unbeknownst to me, the ranking Republican on that particular subcommittee was John Dellenbach, who I got to know a lot better after I moved to the state of Oregon. So this is only the third time in 32 years I've testified to a legislative committee. However, I did testify 5 months ago to your facilities committee. I do have a little bit of trepidation because as president of the Press Corps, which is the Oregon Legislative Correspondents Association, I do have responsibility for managing parking office space and a number of informal duties, and I felt comfortable speaking in that role. I have a little more trepidation in this role because although access issues do come up in my job, one reason is that except for Commissioner Herring, I have quoted all of you in news stories of various sorts, and I actually have more trepidation about Commissioner Herring since he's in my profession. I will not read this testimony as I mentioned.
Thank you.
I learned that lesson very early in Congress. Although I am president of the press corps, we did not discuss these issues or vote on them, and therefore most of the views I will express are my own. I do come with a perspective of before I came to the Statesman Journal in 2000, I spent 20 years as a reporter outside the Willamette Valley, approximately 10 years in Roseburg, where I first met the chairman when he worked for a member I covered intensely. During those years, Roseburg did not have a full-time reporter here. It still does not, but I would cover sessions intermittently, and then the last 2 or 3 weeks of a session I would be based here. When I joined the Mail Tribune in 1989, the political reporter was based in Salem during the session, so... Every 6 months or so, during the start of each 6 or 7 month session, as it were, I'd move with the legislators to Salem, and then a week or two after the session ended, I'd move back to Southern Oregon. And over the course of 11 years with the Mail Tribune, I did this 12 times.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, when I took the job at the Statesman Journal, my mother said, does this mean you won't have to move as often? I would like to say that, in general, the Oregon, in comparison with Congress and another legislature I've observed during my 30-year reporting career, has had a well-deserved reputation for openness. I am concerned, like other people, that for various reasons, some of which are probably beyond the purview of this committee or this commission, there seems to be more of a closure. I'm here to suggest some things, at least within your purview, that we can do to at least deal with some of the problems dealing with public access. Some of these some of these topics have been covered by the prior testimony. I do think the letting people 100 miles or more away from Salem testify first during public testimony is a good idea. I do know, Commissioner Cease, you mentioned public testimony. I do notice a pattern that in my jobs in Roseburg and Medford, it was a trickle at first, but more and more people, especially toward the end of my 10 years in each place, decide to come up and testify. I don't know whether it had anything to do with my coverage or the lack of it, but I would like to think that had something, increasing awareness did have something to do with drawing additional public interest to what was going on up here. Giving 48 hours notice, as was instituted by the 2005 session, was a good move, and moving some of the committee hearings and work sessions outside Salem was a good thing. I can recall that during the 20 years I worked in Roseburg and Medford, I can count on one hand the number of committees I covered actually during hearings outside Salem, and I seem to remember most of them had to do with taxes. there were more committees that had done the such work, but I think in the last session you saw a more concerted effort to do that, and I welcome that, and I think the people in those areas welcome it as well. And I also want to mention the Ways and Means process, using both teleconferencing and field hearings to call attention to the state's budget process was useful. I think teleconferencing could be used more frequently. I understand the Facilities Committee is discussing some of the capabilities of the legislature to do that. Obviously, the teleconferencing should not be used as a substitute for visits. On the other hand, I don't want all the committees to be out doing their work outside the building either. I understand end-of-session imperatives, but I think when the chambers invoke one-hour notice for committee meetings toward the end of the session, it needs to be closer to the actual adjournment. I did not do the research, but I believe one of the other panelists mentioned that that period went on for about 2 months. I think 1 month, as has been done in the past, is probably adequate. 2 months, kind of wonder about that. The concern about delineating what is public testimony from member testimony and invited testimony from agencies, local governments, interest groups, other experts has been mentioned already. This, to me, is not an insurmountable problem. I think it's a matter of training the chairs to try to structure the workload and the hearings such that to set up the framework and background for hearings on a subject or a particular bill can be done, I think the committee chairs can also make clear when public testimony, either within a block of time or during a particular two-hour hearing or during the course of like 1 or 2 weeks. I think that could be easily done. I realize legislative leaders and committee chairs ultimately have the authority to run committees. I have seen people from both political parties and various political persuasions run very good hearings. I've seen others the same run very bad hearings. I realize that this ultimately is a question of the people involved. I think training can help. I do think that because committee sessions are accessible now through streaming on the legislative website, and because they will be broadcast much in real time through the proposed Oregon channel, and I believe there were earlier misstatements, and I think this was a point of discussion before the Facilities Committee earlier this month. Committee chairs will have to do better in explaining just what's going on, organizing the meeting so that there's some sense that there is a real organization, and then having witnesses state their names and speak directly into the microphones.
If I could take you, Peter, you want to move ahead just real quickly to your last paragraph, because this is an issue that the committee, this commission, or this committee of the commission has addressed, which is the ethics, which came before us, I think, I've been here at one of our first meetings, where we talked about the ethics rules of the legislature and talked about the filing rules. I was interested in your views there about your last paragraphs there. If you could comment on that for us.
Okay. Are we talking about both the statements of economic interest and the lobbyist registration?
Yeah.
I was a little leery about talking about these things, but I do know that I know in 30 years ago it was a great step for Oregon, both the legislature to enact these, and I believe it put some of these measures on the ballot, and I believe local governments also had these on the ballot. I think it is wise that we take another look about as to what kind of information we want from such statements. And I do want to point out that either the Government Standards and Practices Commission or whatever body you have to oversee these records, they should have the same access electronically that the legislature in this past session will institute in 2007 for campaign contribution and expenditure reports. Some of these records are simply not accessible to the public the way they should be. In terms of detail, I know that is a subject that's being reviewed now by the Oregon Law Commission. I know there's always a balance between how much detail is of interest to the public, and I do recall during a previous session members of the Capital Club testifying this subject, say, well, nobody but the press is interested in this stuff. To be honest, I would say that people always want to know who's exerting influence, and they want the information in a timely manner. I think the people themselves are the best judge of whether that's undue influence or not. I think that's not subject that we as reporters should pass on, but I think it's a subject that we as reporters should have that information to be made available to the public. And I think also if you have an electronic system for such records, that would go a long way to improve public access, just as I mentioned, the campaign contributions. I skipped caucus meetings partly because we have a division of opinion. I know much of it my colleagues favor it. We have not taken a position as a press corps on that, and I suppose that a resolution of whether caucuses fall under Article 4, Section 14 of the Constitution will have to be resolved in some other manner.
Mr. Shady, you had a question?
It's maybe an unanswerable question, but I couldn't agree with you more that it is the people's government, and ask you to distinguish if you can. Maybe there's a division of labor with regard to the press's responsibility to provide information and the legislature's own responsibility to provide information to the people.
I realize in a democracy there will always be tension between those who are passionate advocates for or against various proposals and those like us whose job it is to report what is going on and why it's going on. And I think there's never going to be any law that resolves that conflict. having said that, I think if... it was pointed out to me that the law governing public records in meetings really does not differentiate between the news media and the public, except in the one instance of executive sessions where news media are allowed to sit in on such sessions, and the general public is not. I don't know if that really answers your question, but I think the legislature, as I mentioned, has done a good job in some areas of records. Some of the records that the chair asked me about are really not, although they are governed by law, are obviously under the control of another agency.
Commissioner Herring.
Peter, is there anything that you can tell us about that this committee could recommend that would make the job of reporters in the legislature easier? Or let me add, in another way, is there anything that is going on now that makes it very difficult that this commission could recommend something about?
I do know that we don't expect necessarily public education guide, but I know that I will say that when I first came here as a young reporter 25 years ago, I learned about how Oregon raises money by covering a number of the sessions that the then legislative revenue officer, Rich Munn, gave to members of the House and Senate Revenue Committees. Now, I realize that a lot of the agreements that were forged to balance the budget in those very difficult years, remember that was 1981 and 1982 were very difficult years for the legislature that balanced the budget. They were not easy agreements, but I think I learned a lot from Rich Mann, how he outlined for legislators and reporters who were willing to pay attention to the basics of how Oregon raises money, how that is done. I suspect that we do have guides. I know the Legislative Revenue Office puts out a guide on basic finance. The fiscal office in recent years has improved on that score. I think there needs to be efforts to the public, not just reporters, as to explain some of the more complicated processes. On issues, I found that many committee administrators are very good if you take an interest in whatever it is that that you're covering. But it's something that the most dedicated, it's not something that a reporter can necessarily parachute in on. It's something that I guess it's up to the reporter and his editors to, for example, covering the methamphetamine legislation. That was an effort, certainly, where it was clear that despite partisan and perhaps ideological differences, there was cooperation. But it was something that if you would know only if you, as a reporter, had followed that all the way. I think maybe more issue briefs sometimes in terms of summarizing the key facts of an issue that the legislature is dealing with would be helpful. I know there is research out there. It's just that reporters have to learn how to find it. There's no necessary central mechanism as to how that's done. Were you thinking of other things, Commissioner?
Okay, I just wondered if there was any particular institutional hurdle that makes it difficult for reporters such as yourself, locally based or from out of town in Medford or any place else, to cover what goes on. I mean, you're barred from certain kinds of procedures, or that you can't get certain kinds of records, or that they don't let you enough in the building before 11 o'clock, or anything like that. And I gather from your answer that there isn't any such thing.
In Oregon, I have found very little of any saying, no, you can't
do
this.
It's a very open place, isn't it?
Yeah. In general, yes. I think if there are faults, it's faults probably of omission rather than commission.
Well, I think that's, and I agree with that. I every once in a while, almost after every legislative session, 2 or 3 months later, something pops up that says, gee, we didn't know that they did that. And nobody paid any attention to it at the time. That is, none of the reporters from the people who cover the legislature, I mean, the Capitol all the time. But I'm not sure that that is anybody's fault particularly, because chances are that at the time nobody thought it was important.
And as you note in your written testimony, Peter, this committee quickly disposed of the proposal to ban reporters from the floor of the House and Senate. So we sent.
I am sure that goes back to statehood.
We sent that packing. So
I am not sure why it was an issue in the first place. Although I do know that, it's particularly in one chamber, it does get very noisy.
Mr. Schutte, any other questions?
Well, maybe Hasso and I are just beating the same horse, and it's over. But is there anything that we could do actively to assist? I've believe in many regards the press is our only hope, particularly considering the staffing levels of the current legislature, for us to the people to really get the kind of information we need. Is there anything that we could actively do that would assist
the press in covering the legislature. Maybe we're not putting up any barriers, but is there anything that we could do?
I know from, I was thinking of an example from approximately a decade ago when this was after when the property tax limitation measures passed, and the legislature was faced with the job of rewriting it to both satisfy the political desires of the electorate and yet straighten out the obvious flaws in the measure as they affected local government and others. And I think, if I recall correctly, both the chairman, who was Republican, and the vice chair of the House Revenue Committee at the time, a Democrat, sat down with us and with the legislative revenue officer and said, look, here's what we need to do. And it wasn't an off-the-record thing. It was clearly on the record, but they said, here's the problems we face, and here's how we think we can fix them, and so forth. And I don't expect members who are already too busy to do that all the time on every issue, but I think once in a while, I think that would be very helpful. I think some of it has to be initiative coming from us as well. I think we can't just expect them to be handed. We expect to be handed this kind of.
Representative Boone, you still with us?
I'm still here.
Oh my gosh, you are so patient. Don't you have anything better to do?
I'm about to leave you though.
Okay. Any final thoughts or comments?
I wanted to hear the rest of Peter's testimony.
Well, thanks for being with us, Representative Boone, and thank you, Peter, for being with us.
Okay, I think I've pretty much covered what I wanted to say.
And I assume your story tomorrow will say that the committee asked penetrating and insightful questions. And, thanks for being with us. We've been here since 1. We've got one more panel to go. Does anybody need a 5-minute break, or should we power through? So.
Okay,
5-minute break, and we'll start back at 3:30 with Mr. Dole. And so.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Boone.
Thank you. I think I'll sign off now.
Okay.
And Marjorie, if I can just get...
after our short recess, and we're joined now by Steve Dole, the Executive Director of Crime Victims United, and Ann Pratt with Oregon Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Actually, Crime Victims United.
Crime Victims United as well. And Steve was with us beforehand. I think Ann was earlier in one of our meetings in the past to talk to us about the issue of alcohol consumption inside the Capitol, and we had a good early discussion of it, and Steve and I talked afterwards, and I asked him to come back with a concrete proposal, and I think he's done that today.
So. Oh, I want to say this. First of all, while I am president of Crime Victims United, I come here not representing Crime Victims United today, but rather as a citizen of the state of Oregon. And I also want to say that the work product you see in front of you is all the hard work of my friend, Mrs. Pratt. Okay. So she's responsible for this, and she did a great job on it, by the way.
Right now, as committee members will recall, this issue arose when Steve and others were lobbying in the last days of the last session on an issue specifically relating, ironically enough, to driving under the influence, and it was their experience that some of the legislators they were talking to perhaps were under the influence during the last days of the session. And Steve raised the issue that had an impact on people's, certainly their opinion, the people who were dealing with them at the time, of the legislature and its effectiveness. And that's what led to this discussion. So with that, Steve, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair Tim Chuck, members of the committee. I do want to make this clear, as I stated before, that I've lobbied. I'm not an old-time lobbyist, but I've been here for 8 sessions, and I've been here on sine die for 4 of those sessions. And that's when we generally have seen this situation. And as I stated earlier, it isn't something that's new. I've seen it many times. It was hard to turn a blind eye to it this time because of the issue that we were lobbying and because of the people who I was lobbying with, 2 mothers who had lost family members to drunken drivers. But in talking to many members of the present legislature and some members of previous legislators, you know, none of them were too surprised by this, or several of them said, in fact, they've said, well, it's about time we do something about this. So that was a general attitude I got, and I think that going into the session and when the session was done, the president of the current Senate himself said that we need to do something about the integrity and respect for the body, and I certainly think this is one of those issues that leads to a lack of respect and a lack of integrity when we have people who are drinking on the job. And I think that, again, is something that we ask people, certainly in the private sector, the sector that I came from before I was involved in politics. We just didn't tolerate it in the corporation I was with. It was just not tolerated, and I think it's gotten less tolerable today from what I understand.
Administrator Taylor has provided the committee members with a summary of rules, ORSs in Department of Administrative Service policy manuals regarding alcohol consumption and alcohol possession in state buildings. And the DAS policy manual, if I'm correct reading this right, Administrator Taylor, does prohibit possession or use of alcoholic beverages in state office buildings. However, there is a alcohol risk control policy here in the state capitol. Yes. States that the legislative administration committee will permit alcohol use in the capitol on approval in writing of the legislative administrator. And Dave Henderson is with us here in the back of the room, the administrator, if anyone has any questions. The policy requires beverages to be served by a licensed server, specific insurance, variety, and consistent supply of food, time limit of 90 minutes on serving beverages, consumption to the Capitol only, and no self-service bar. That is the current state of affairs on alcohol use in the Capitol.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to point out that there are no House or Senate rules that address the possession or consumption of alcohol by members and staff currently.
And what you're proposing, Steve and Ann, is a change to the Senate and House rules, of which there are none, as Administrator Taylor said, currently that govern this issue.
House and Senate.
You want to walk us through your proposal here?
Sure, I'll let Ann do that.
I'd also like to add that in the last few months, I've spoken to a lot of people, the general public, about how they feel about alcohol in the Capitol building and legislators drinking on the job, and I got various responses, but in checking with friends who work for corporations, I have a friend who works for Levi Strauss, and I said, how would Levi handle this? And I think it's pretty typical of corporations, large corporations, would be a written reprimand the first time. The second time would be immediate termination. So I think we're really, with our proposal, we're really in line with what's happening.
Your proposal would prohibit legislators and their staff from the use of alcoholic beverages and the use of illegal drugs during working hours and within the Capitol building, correct?
While conducting business in the Capitol building.
So your proposal only governs, obviously, here in the Capitol building.
I believe there isn't any other, yes.
Right, okay.
That would be a question or concern to have you. Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Steve.
Thank you. I had the same question. The on-the-job phrasing, legislators are never not on the job.
I would think you're limiting the Capitol building.
If they went to an entertainment function by someplace out, away from the Capitol, that was given by your organization, and it probably wouldn't be served at your organization, but there are many where there are, and
right.
I'm an alcoholic and I don't drink anymore, so I'm safe, and I'm not in the legislature anymore, thank goodness. But I think you need to consider that if you're talking about at the Capitol versus the on-the-job concept, because it's you're never not on the job.
I think there's a definition of they're on the job, and it relates to floor sessions, committee meetings. Any related meetings having to do with conducting legislative business, any meeting where there's interaction with the general public, governmental agency, governmental or agency employees and legislators or lobbyists.
In the Capitol or someplace else?
In the Capitol.
In the Capitol. In the Capitol. Okay.
Does that clarify?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
And then you have some consequences. First rule violation is a written reprimand by the Senate President or Speaker of the House, a fine. And then a second violation is a floor suspension, a larger fine, assessment and treatment, other options here. Reporting can be reported by anyone observing legislators and their staff drinking on the job, intoxicated or impaired on the job. Complaint must be in writing and signed by the individual who witnessed the behavior, filed within 24 hours to remain confidential. So this is, your proposal is use of alcohol, period, drinking, period. It's not under the influence, it's just no use of alcohol in the Capitol. Is that?
Well, specifically, we're trying to get back to is working, you know, during the, so that nobody is under the influence that is drinking while they're in floor sessions, committee meetings, as listed on the job, so that we can stay away from that. I mean, if someone, you know, goes out to lunch and has a glass of wine with lunch, that's not going to make us jump. That's not what we're talking about here. Or maybe Ms. Cease, former Senator Cease, indicated, maybe they go in the afternoon to a function, have one glass of wine, come back, and have another floor meeting or a committee or some type of a meeting. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about what we've seen where you're dealing with people who are, that you can smell alcohol and who appear to be impaired.
Ms. Herring.
I'm sorry to say that I don't have the proposal exactly in front of me, but how would the reporting be done? Okay, so you see somebody like that at the end of the session who you think is drunk. And so you make the report, and do you make them, you give them a test? You make them touch his nose? You make them walk a line?
Well, that's certainly one of the possibilities, but
you call in the state police and say, this guy I think is drunk. Then the cop comes in and he says, Senator, let me hold out your arm.
No, we're referring it to the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate for action that they want to take with the individual.
Well, presumably by the time they get around to taking action, some time will have passed, and even if he was drunk, chances are he's no longer so. And that would be the case.
It would be the case.
So somebody comes in and knows he's going to run against somebody the next election and says, runs into him. He acts a little funny, and so he makes a report. I think he's drunk. And, of course, nothing can be proved. But something is in the record somewhere that there's a report that at the end of the session, such and so, Senator so and so was drunk. Surely in the next election, that's going to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be better if it were reported by two individuals?
Well, I don't know however many partisans you can assemble to do that. I'm not sure that the number would make a whole lot of difference. I certainly sympathize with your impression that it makes, with a very bad impression that it makes on anybody when a legislator or anybody else in public life is impaired in some way while he's at work. I'm just wondering whether or not there's any remedy beyond working against that person in the next election.
And that's, I want to, Chair Timchuck and Mr. Herring, that's not our purpose here. But I understand your concern, but that's not what we're trying to do. I can tell you this, I'm certainly not getting ready to run for office now or at any time. I just want to be clear that's why we're talking here today. I think that's an excellent point, and that's something that we certainly don't want to have happen. This proposal is a starting point for discussion to see, you know, if there's another way to do it, if we want to go forward, what we want to do with it. I will say this, though, this issue of a bad impression, I think having someone who is making laws who is impaired is beyond bad impression. It's if you're voting on a very serious bill, let's take the fact that this was a drunken driving issue out of it. But if you're voting on a finance bill for the state of Oregon, if you're voting on a mental health bill, if you're any number of these are all very serious issues. Yeah, once in a while we have issues in the legislature that probably don't even belong there, I will admit. Like we had something about snails last year. I forget what it was in the legislature, eating the consumption of snails in restaurants. But when we're doing the people's business and voting on very serious issues, to know that we have people in those chambers that are impaired while they're casting a vote is, I think, it's beyond just being a little bit troubling. So,
well, I think the point that Commissioner Herring was making, and maybe I'm wrong, isn't the best way. One of the best ways perhaps to deal with this, say the senator was from Albany, Commissioner Herring's hometown, where he happens to publish paper. Isn't the best way to take care of it is for you to go to Commissioner Herring or go to the local paper and say, hey, Senator Smith is, you know, legislative under the influence. Come and do a story about that. Isn't that the best way to end it?
No, it may be. I guess, again, much like you have in any private sector situation where people police their own, that's what we were kind of looking for here, is for the Senate and for there to be some mechanism for the Senate and the House to police their own, so that people like myself who are lobbyists don't go around like tattletales, to the local newspaper and to others saying, do you know this? I mean, I said this before, and I don't want to be repetitive. We're not trying to be moralists here, or I'm not a teetotaler. I like a good cold beer as much as the next guy does. And it's just a matter of this issue of not drinking on the job. That's really the key issue. Because it's one thing in a private corporation, and again, they have to police their own, but when you're an elected official, when you're doing the people's business, and when it's as important and critical as what we have in front of us in the state of Oregon today on so many levels, to have people, again, casting votes when they're impaired is just trouble, more than trouble.
One might think that half the votes cast under some impairment, depending on how judging by the results. But what I was really trying to get at is I think we all agree that it is not good for Oregon or for anybody if somebody is drunk and legislates. But unlike drunken driving, where you have some way to enforce it, because police officers are out there, and when they see somebody acting funny, they do something about it. And they do it right away. I just don't see what the mechanism would be for trying to enforce it, other than I don't see what the formal, I'm asking what sort of a formal mechanism there might be, or you might think of. For my own part, I would think that the easiest way, or the normal way to get to take care of a problem like that when you come across it, is to take the person aside. Say, I don't think you're in any shape to drive or to legislate. Let me take you out and in the lounge and have you sit down for a while. But if that doesn't work, one might go to the committee chairperson, or to the caucus leader, or to the Senate president, or to the House speaker, and say, such and so is really in bad shape. I don't think you ought to let him get in the chamber.
Ms. Pratt?
On that line, I remember in the 2003 session, really the first session, that I participated as a lobbyist, and my effort to pass tougher DUI bills, there was a senator who had a drinking problem. And I know that he was spoken to by his fellow legislators, many legislators, many times. And it would be my view that if there was someone with a problem, it would doubtfully be the first time that someone would file a complaint. And there would be a process. If there's a process for sexual harassment in the workplace in the House and Senate rules, there's a complete process. And at the end of the process, which does go to the Senate, Secretary of the Senate, to the Senate President, and also the other route through the House, it goes to a committee. And at the end of that process, if that that complaint is unfounded, then the complaint's dismissed.
I'm wondering if there isn't some difference between that and being drunken. I mean, what we thought about the alcohol content, the only way to know whether that actually happened or whether such and so always acts like a jerk is to actually measure the blood. So you need to get a sample. Whereas, I mean, we know how difficult it is to prove sexual harassment. And, you know, there's long investigations about that. Lots of testimony being taken and so on. And I just wonder whether that's the appropriate approach for this kind of a thing. Where if the informal approach doesn't work, I don't know what to suggest, frankly, but I just don't see where a formal one can work without making legislators take a breath.
Well, it's a great deterrent.
Mr. Schutte?
I want to make sure that I'm reading what we have in front of us correctly. It is already against DS policies to have alcohol and to use alcohol in the building.
That's DAS, but we're the legislative branch. In the Capitol.
You don't count. This is the...
Those don't apply to us.
These apply to other state office buildings, not the Capitol.
Well, seems to me that there ought to be. And whether or not we can fully figure out the process that will be effective, certainly having the prohibition is appropriate.
Administrator, before we have Judge Pryor's question, Administrator Chet and I have talked, and what I'd like to do, Stephen and Ann, is to take this proposal and to circulate it with a letter from myself to the Secretary of the Senate, the Clerk of the House, the Speaker, the President of the Senate, the Legislative Administrator, the Legislative Council, and ask for their thoughts and recommendations on how to deal with this issue, if there's a better way, if strengths and weaknesses of this proposal, what they see. and get their opinions on this.
When I talked to Ms. Taylor the other day, she said that she suggested there would be two ways, and it would be by changing chamber rules,
right,
or by way of a bill. And my personal view from the very beginning about this issue, starting back in August when it occurred, was I still believe that it should be handled within.
Right. And I suspect that the leadership may be sensitive to this issue because of the issue involving the representative from Corvallis last session, who had her problems just prior.
Yeah, I agree. I think something needs to be done. I think we're talking about consequences for bad conduct. And I agree with the chair and what he's proposing. I'm sure that we will pay attention to this.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. I would like to say I certainly understand Mr. Herring's concern, and I share some of those concerns, but I think it's just like when they put the issue around sexual harassment into the rules, it certainly brought the awareness up, and I think we've cut a lot of that out from what used to happen, say, just 20 years ago. And I think that this may do the same thing by having something in there and bringing the awareness. And, you know, I certainly have concern and feeling for people that have a real drinking problem. And the issue here is to just, again, make sure that it's not taking place when we're doing very serious business for the people of Oregon.
I'd like to add one more thing, if you don't mind, 2 seconds here, on the issue of the representative from Corvallis. One reason that we put in here the mandatory assessment is because what hindsight was somebody should have helped her. And there were people who did know she had a problem. They maybe weren't sure of what it was, but she clearly needed some help.
It probably goes without saying that this is the reason this topic is so difficult, because there are both personal, which you have anyway, personal sensitivities around issues of drug and alcohol use, but there's also, in this case, political sensitivities because of the relationship between lobbyists and legislators. Thank you. Thanks very much.
We do have a time for a public comment. Is there any members of the public who wanted to comment on anything we've heard today? So, if not, committee members, I think our next meeting may be a work session, I think is what I propose. I think we have a lot of issues before us now, and we've discussed them and heard witnesses, and I think we probably have enough information to go through a vast majority of issues before this committee and dispose of them by moving them forward or by not. So that would be my proposal. Be Commissioner Sees?
I just want to say thank you to everybody for putting up with me today.
You were most welcome to have you here. So you're dressed in appropriately for St. Patrick's Day week, too, I noticed. So.
Oh, what about that?
So,
will we have sort of an overview?
Yes, I think we'll have an overview. Yes. Administrator Taylor and I will work to present an agenda and an overview and options of things we can do. So, I don't know if we want to calendar now because a couple of us are gone. So, but why don't we do it via email?
Sure.
And we'll throw out some dates and have a meeting and take care of a lot of the business. When's the next full commission meeting?
The next full commission meeting is a short meeting scheduled for April 12th, probably in the afternoon. The next all-day commission meeting is scheduled for May 22nd.
And I believe the April meeting, its intention is to take care of the annual session question.
The session structure question.
So
if all goes as planned.
Which may impact some recommendations of this committee as well. So I think we need to wait until after April 12th before we have our next meeting. Commissioner Pryor.
Mr. Chair, I know that there's some concern on the part of the co-chairs and staff that we don't have a lot of months left to get this done. So I'm going to ask you, am I hearing you say that this committee probably wouldn't take any more testimony? We just get to work on the issues? Is that what
Mr. Taylor, I think we're pretty close to that. I don't want to make the 100% guarantee right now. Let us review what we've heard and done. But I think we're pretty close to that. We've heard on all the major issues that are before us.
Okay.
Ethics training.
Okay.
Public access. So So, well, let's get back to you on that. So.
Okay.
And I report to the legislative administrator, Dave, that Commissioner Schutte just broke the podium here.
I
you may want to.
She's
a troublemaker. You may want to bill her.
Elmer's.
She was chewing on the end.
With that, we can't adjourn. So.